Good morning. Every year at Christmas time, gifts start showing up in the office for the staff. People bring us in candy, cookies, nuts, fruit. It's such a loving gesture, and we really appreciate it. It's also a great way for me to put on a few pounds in the month of December. But this year, a gift showed up that really delighted me. It's a dish towel. And on it, it says, "Does anyone know which page of the Bible explains how to turn water into wine?" Asking for a friend. I just thought that was so great. And I don't know what page it's on, but I do know where we get this reference, right? What's being referenced here is the story that we hear in the gospel message today, what's come to be known as the wedding at Cana. And it's a familiar story to most of us. And it comes from, it's this little story, as I said, and, you know, skeptics will say, well, that's impossible. Water is water. Wine is wine. Never the twain shall meet. I don't know. That's not a very good metaphor to use there. But it couldn't have happened. We're too much too smart to believe such an outlandish story. And some of us who believe that Jesus was capable of miraculous interventions into this supposedly mundane world that we live in, we say, of course, it happened. And some of us understand that there's a deeper meaning in the story. Wow, if it happened once, could it happen again? Could I turn water into wine? Asking for a friend, right? Ironically distancing myself from the miracle. And there's humor in the towel, and what delights me about this account of the wedding at Cana is that there's a subtle humor throughout the story. Sometimes I wish there was a little more humor in the Bible. It's there in many places. You have to look for it sometimes. But yeah, I think sometimes we just need to lighten up a little bit. Because I don't think that humor is necessarily frivolous. And I think frivolous humor is great. I just love that when something just silly and outlandish happens and it just, a belly laugh just erupts from me. I don't know where it comes from. But I think that there's just this beauty in humor and in laughing. And enlightening up a little bit. Well, that's what the towel did for me that day that I found it in the kitchen, engrossed in 101 different things that have to be attended to in the run-up to Christmas. And so thanks, whoever brought that towel. I really appreciate it. So, you know, I said I find some humor in this story of the wedding at Cana. And you might be saying, well, where do you find that? Well, let's think about it a little bit. By the way, when I say it's humorous, I don't mean to say that it's a joke, right? And any joke that needs explaining clearly doesn't work, right? So it's not a joke, and it's definitely not a riddle. It's this brief, light little interlude in the midst of a pretty heavy gospel. John's gospel is definitely heavy reading. It's loaded with what biblical scholars call a high Christology. That is, it leans heavily into Jesus' divinity, his oneness with God the Father. And you're probably familiar with what we call the prologue to John, those opening verses. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things come into being through him, and without him, not one thing is made. What has come into being within him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. It's a beautiful, poetic, theological statement at the beginning of the book of John. And then near the end of the book, the author shows his hand when he says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name." So these are the bookends of the story, right? And there's plenty of heavy theological argument and apologetics in between. Not much room for humor, perhaps, which is okay, but I just love this little story of the wedding at Cana as Jesus' first public sign. So if we consider the passage, it begins on the third day. The third day of the week, of the month, of the year, doesn't say. But it's probably a reference to cosmic time, right? In the prologue, we hear about the first day of creation and Jesus's, the Word, his presence there. Then the next beat of the story, what happens right before this, is Jesus gathers up his disciples. So suddenly we're at a wedding, and it's the third day. Jesus' mother was there. She was probably a friend of the family, and Jesus and his friends have been invited too. Now, in those days in Jewish culture, weddings were these lavish affairs. They were a week-long feast and partying, lavish in a way that it might even be hard for us to comprehend. Parents of brides, consider this. It wasn't just a ceremony and a reception. It lasted a week. And then when the wine gave out, this is a big deal, right? Understand, there was no cash bar after the band started. The wine was provided by the family and expected by the guests. It's a major faux pas to run out of wine. Right? And it's potentially an extremely embarrassing moment for the family, though they didn't even seem to recognize it in the moment, right? It was Jesus' mother who recognized it. And this may say something profound about Jesus' mother, right? Her vigilance and her caring for the well-being of other people. She calls Jesus aside and simply says, "They have no wine." And Jesus says, "And? Am I supposed to do something about it? It may not be my time, and Mom, it may not be yours either." And I can imagine a small smile at the corner of Jesus' mother's mouth as she finds a servant and whispers to them, "Do whatever he tells you." She knew something about Jesus that he didn't even know about himself, that when called upon, he couldn't not help, that his time and his place had indeed come, and that it was time for a sign. There were 6 stone water jugs standing there, big jars, 20 or 30 gallons each, so enough to hold roughly 150 gallons. And they were there to contain water, and the water in these jars was to be used for washing up, first of all, for the guests, but it's more than that. It's a ritual purification that the guests at the wedding were doing. They were coming in and they were purifying themselves before they entered this holy party. And the guest at the feast burned through 150 gallons of purificating water. It must have been quite a bash if you think about it. Jesus tells the servants, fill these stone jars up again. And just like Jesus' mother had instructed them, they do. Here's where things get interesting, and I think that the thread of humor kind of runs through. How did he turn water into wine? Did he even do it? Again, John does not say, and neither does Jesus. He tells the servants, draw some out and take it to the wine steward, the guy who must have known that they were running out of wine anyway, whose job may have been on the line in that moment. Draw some water out that you just poured into these stone jars and take it to the steward. So they did. Think about the last wedding that you went to. If it was in Jackson Hole, it was probably catered. And the people who were serving you your hors d'oeuvres and setting your place of food in front of you and then taking them away when you were done, they were probably cobbling together two or three jobs to survive in Jackson Hole. And I like to think of them as the ones who Jesus said, draw out some water and take it to the wedding planner. She's probably pretty stressed out. And the wedding planner, the steward, takes the water that has become wine and goes, wow, something like that. And maybe thinks, I don't know how it happened or where this wine came from, but my career has just been saved. So she goes to the bridegroom, and more likely the father of the bride, to keep it in Jackson Hole context, and starts laying it on thick. You have kept the good wine until now. You have saved the best for last. Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Thus endeth the lesson. Nope, not this lesson, because it reverberates throughout the rest of John's gospel as the one sign that Jesus said, that Jesus performed, that he neither gives God credit for nor explains what it means. It was a generous, free act of love. It was a sign of love for those servants, for that wine steward, for the bride and groom, and for all of the people who were attending that wedding feast as guests. And it was an act of love for his mother, the woman who was there at his birth, here in his first public sign, and who would be there at the foot of the cross as he was dying. It was a sign of love for his mom, even despite this testy little exchange that they had at the beginning. It's a simple act of grace and generosity, freely given, so that the party may go on. There's joy in that, and there is joy in the lesson to be gleaned at the wedding of Cana. And it is this: the party will go on. And ultimately, it will be better than anyone ever expected. And as one who tries his best to follow Jesus, I believe this. And in the same breath, I want to say that for many throughout history and for many today, and for some sitting in this room, life is no party. It's much worse than that for the people who've been burned out of their homes and their communities in California. And it's worse than that for the people in Ukraine and for the people in Israel, Africa, and in many places in the U.S. and abroad. And how can any person with any awareness of the suffering of the people of the world How can I say to them the party will go on better than ever? I don't know. I don't have a logical, evidence-based answer to work on here. But I do have faith, in spite of every reason not to. James, in his epistle, famously said that faith without works is dead. It's also possible that works without faith is also dead. And how can we find ways to work faithfully in a world that is groaning under the weight of so much tragedy? Well, perhaps this story shows us the way. There are three beats to the story. The first step is to keep our eyes open. Jesus' mother recognized the need that day, the lack at the wedding party, and she knew that there was nothing that she could do about it. But she did know someone who could, even though he didn't want to. Her son, Jesus. Second beat is listen. Again, Jesus at first didn't want to hear what his mother was saying to him, but something changed and he became willing. And the third beat is to act. Back to my favorite towel. Does anyone know which page of the Bible explains how to turn water into wine? I don't know what page it's on because it's not in there. The how is never explained. It's not a magic trick. It's not a script of incantations to make things better. Only God knows how that transformation comes to be. But the why is pretty evident. There was a lack. He heard it. And even though that he didn't think that perhaps he was up to the task, Jesus went ahead and filled that need. Then surprisingly, humbly, he took no credit for his generosity. And the party went on. Brothers and sisters, we can't party alone. It just doesn't work. It's not a party. But together we can celebrate. You know, today we can celebrate a new year. We can celebrate a new life in God's grace and through our graciousness towards one another. And we can try to hold on to a little humor, even when, or maybe especially when, times seem darkest. So I'm going to leave you with a great line that I love from a song by Robert Earl Keane. It goes like this. The road goes on forever, and the party never ends. So brothers and sisters, party on.